drama that is the human condition. You know that human behavior is often shrouded in mystery. Why do we do what we do, how we act, and what we think about at 4 a.m. are at the heart of what makes us who we are, and in fact, even what makes us interesting. But what if we reveal everything about ourselves? Facebook and LinkedIn and social networks in general track our every move, our every action. If every thought is posted or tweeted or shared, then where is the mystery? Least we forget that we are more than the sum total of our data points. This is what we're going to talk about today with my guest, Andrew Keen. He's the author of the critically acclaimed The Cult of the Amateur. He's a Silicon Valley entrepreneur. His writing has appeared in numerous publications, including The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and The Economist. It is my pleasure to welcome Andrew Keen back to this program to talk about his new book, Digital Vertigo, How Today's Online Social Revolution is Dividing, Diminishing, and Distorting Us. Andrew Keen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Delighted to have you here. Is this the price that we're paying for kind of the decline of liberal arts education in this country?
It's interesting that you talk about the price, because it's the price of free services like Facebook and Google. The price, of course, of free is that when we give our most intimate data to these services, they're using that data and turning us into products.
Turning us into products in a culture that has turned us more and more into consumers. In some ways, it's the flip side of this consumer culture that's been growing for 25, 30 years.
Yeah, Jeff, but it's all too easy to blame other people. People need to blame themselves. When you say the culture that's been turning us into consumers, no one's really forcing any of us to reveal all this intimate data about ourselves. So we need to think about ourselves. It's all too easy to blame somebody else.
To what extent, though, is it generational? And the world that people that are younger today, that millennials, have grown up in?
I don't think it is generational, because when you look at the numbers, it's not just the kids. It's you and I. It's people in their 30s and 40s who are pasting more and more photos of their infants and their kids on Facebook or on Twitter. So I don't think there is a generational element. But I think it would be wrong to simply say, well, the kids are doing this and the grown-ups have maintained their sensibleness. It's not the case. We've all fallen under this great seduction of social media. We're all now suffering from vertigo or digital vertigo.
And it's often in the guise of this transparency, as if total transparency is somehow a good thing.
Yeah, I'm a big critic of this idea of radical transparency. You often hear it articulated by social media utopians, that we can live in a world of complete transparency. Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook says that he'd like to live in a world where Facebook has become a giant dorm room, a well-lit dorm room for the planet. I don't want to live there. I've got secrets. I don't want people knowing everything I'm doing. And the problem is, it's not just Facebook. We're building out in Silicon Valley an infrastructure of products and apps and platforms where everything we do, everywhere, everything we think, everything we buy, everywhere we go, what we listen to, what we watch, what we eat, where we fly, where we drive, all this is being broadcast on the network. So it's terrifying.
And the other part of it, as you also talk about, is that this data is there forever, that it doesn't degenerate in any way.
Right. That's one of our big challenges. We've got to figure out how to teach the Internet how to forget. If it is to become the real platform for life in the 21st century, which for better or worse it's becoming, it needs to become more human. And we have built a civilization of forgetting, not of remembering. And the only way that the Internet can become a civilized place as if it learns how to forget. And that can be done, of course, through legislation, but it also can be done by products and technology.
The other part of it is, and I want to come back to the products and technology, but the other part of it is this sense of privacy, this sense of constantly being on, of broadcasting yourself essentially all the time, and not having any place to escape to, not having any place to find anonymity.
Yeah, this is the core of my argument. I think we are turning ourselves inside out, and as you said in your wonderful introduction, we're losing what it is that it is to be human. We're losing that core meaning, that secrecy, that mystery that represents the engine room in the formation of personality, of uniqueness of each of us as normal people in Silicon Valley, from Google's Eric Schmidt to TechCrunch's Mike Arrington, have all talked almost in a celebratory way about the death of privacy, as if that's a good thing, as if it's like the death of the horse and cart or the gaslight. But of course it isn't. It's the death of something which is quintessentially human and impoverishes us as a species.
And it's the death of depth, as you talk about, that there's a certain shallowness to all of this, a certain surface appeal to all of it.
Absolutely. We are being spinned out as a species. When everyone knows everything we're doing, we're no longer interesting. If I meet you, if we're talking now in this conversation, and I know everything about you, your passions, your interests, that doesn't make you more interesting. There are these new supposed social location services like Glancy and Highlight now, which enable you and I, if we were in a bar, to meet even though we were strangers. And we would know everything about each other. We would know our passions, our habits, our personal data, our education, where we work. It doesn't make us any more interesting. It's mystery that makes us interesting. If I meet you as a stranger, serendipitously on a plane or a train or at a cocktail party, I don't want to know everything about you, because that takes away from, again, the great mystery, the miracle of actually forming friendships, of learning about you. You simply become another data point.
And this is something that we see in art. It's part of art. It's part of novels. It's part of movies, as you talk about. It's part of human psychology. And it all, and this part does seem to be generational, because you talk to younger people about these things, and it seems to be lost on them in some way.
Well, again, I'm not sure if that's the case. My book, and I hope there are some young people listening to this, I hope they'll have a chance to read it. My book, not uncoincidentally, given what you said, is built, the narrative is built around movies, mm-hmm. And pictures and paintings. It's built around Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, Johannes Vermeer's Woman in Blue. And I think that young people are just as capable of appreciating Hitchcock's Vertigo or Vermeer's Woman in Blue or the Social Network movie or the Truman Show or any of the other cultural artifacts that I use in my book. So I'm not convinced that this is just a generational issue, or it's even a cultural decline issue. There's something more profound and fundamental going on. It has to do with a shift from an industrial to a knowledge economy, and these very profound shifts in the way we do our business and the way in which we use identity.
But yet inherent in that is this irony that you talk about, that in this knowledge-based economy, creativity becomes the coin of the realm, and that creativity to be successful is not something that can be crowdsourced, but something that has to be individualized.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's another very important argument that I'm making in the book, is that we live, again, for better or worse, in an economy defined by innovation, by creativity, by our ability to reinvent ourselves and reinvent our products. You know, a classic example of that in the Valley is a Steve Jobs at Apple. But in a world where everything is becoming collectivized, where we have what I call the cult of the social, where companies now require you to be on these networks, there's no privacy, Susan, and there's no innovation. We need to escape from the mob, from the crowd, from groupthink. Susan Cain writes brilliantly about this in her book Quiet. And I follow up on in Digital Vertigo. That's why I go back to John Stuart Mill's argument in On Liberty in the middle of the 19th century and argue in a similar time. Mill was protecting the uniqueness, the innovation of the individual in the early collectivism of the Industrial Revolution, and I'm doing the same in the early years of our digital revolution.
Talk about those parallels and what we can learn from that experience in the Industrial Revolution and the sort of collective mentality that went along with that.
We can learn that it can go either way. Think about what happened, what came out of the Industrial Revolution. We had the catastrophes, the human catastrophes of fascism and communism. But at the same time, the Industrial Revolution also resulted in democracy and in the success of works like Mill in carving out new spaces for the individual. So at the early point in the digital revolution, and it can go either way. We can go towards a new kind of collective dictatorship, a dictatorship of governments that use data to watch everything we do, of companies like Facebook and Google that have acquired huge amounts of data about us, a dictatorship of what I call small brothers, the opposite of Orwell's Big Brother. Or it can become a healthy world in which we do more and more live online and we network, but at the same time we've carved out space for the individual to protect their privacy and secrecy and mystery and remain innovative and the core engine of human progress. It's up to us. The story is in many ways is yet to be written. We're in the very early stages of the digital 21st century.
When we look at this phenomenon worldwide, and we look at it in places outside of America, what do you see? The same things, or are you seeing it manifesting itself somewhat differently?
Well, in some ways, it's very similar. Certainly in Europe, it's very similar. We have this explosion of personal data, certainly in authoritarian cultures or states like Russia or China. The data is being used more and more by government to spy on their citizens, although to be fair, in the UK, in the US, the government's eyes are growing larger and larger as it understands it, to acquire more and more data about us. I'm very skeptical of all this paranoia about terrorism, using it as an excuse mm-hmm. to spy on citizens in America. So I think generally it's very similar. I think what I would say is that we're on the verge of another massive internet revolution. I mean, there's currently about 2 billion people on the internet, mostly from the industrialized or post-industrial world. We're about to see a huge explosion of people from the less developed world, particularly from Africa and Asia, coming online. That's because we're living more and more in a post-PC age. They're coming on through smartphones and smart devices like tablets. And I think this shift towards publicness, towards revealing everything about yourself, is going to have an even more traumatic impact on more traditional cultures. I think it's had less of a traumatic impact on our culture because many of the themes that I write about in my book, narcissism, the tendency to talk more and more about oneself, already existed in Western American European culture even before the digital revolution.
The other part is the degree to which putting everything out there about ourselves, putting all this information out there to the public, in some way changes the essence of who we are.
It does. I mean, it means that we become like these sandwich board men who walk around with data about ourselves on our clothes. Our identities are defined not inwards, but externally. We're dependent on others for defining who we are. And I think that makes us more vulnerable. It makes us more narcissistic. And it also fragments us. It takes away that core thing which represents the anchor of the individual, or has done during the industrial modern age.
You talked about government a few minutes ago. There's also the way in which the corporate world, multinational corporations in particular, large corporations, are taking advantage of this and the impact that that's going to have.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we need to remind ourselves is that the big data companies are no better or worse than big oil companies or military producers or car companies. Google in particular has done a brilliant job over the last 10 years branding, marketing itself as a company bent on the public interest. I think many people who use Google sometimes think that it's not even a for-profit company. A lot of people still don't really understand how it makes its money, but it makes a fortune through the sale of advertising. Facebook, of course, is the same, and many other companies as well. And these companies, their whole essence is built on taking our data and one way or the other using it to leverage large amounts of cash out of advertisers. So I think your listeners need to be very wary of how they use their data. Last week, it doesn't have to be that way. Microsoft came up with a reform in which they're committed to a do not track feature in their new browser, which means that if you use the new Microsoft browser, you're guaranteed that advertisers won't be able to track you. Now, I personally actually don't use the Microsoft browser, but it may well convince me in the future to use it. And I hope that other browsers like Firefox and even Google's Chrome will follow Microsoft. It's doubtful, though, with a company like Google because of their dependence on this free economy, because we use Google for free. So the only way they can make their money is by selling advertising around their product.
When people like Zuckerberg and Eric Schmidt and others talk about this lack of privacy, this, you know, one identity out there in the world, do they believe it, or is it just a naivete about the world and about the human condition?
Well, let me give you two examples, and I think the answer is twofold. I think Mark Zuckerberg does believe it. I think he's essentially a very brilliant but naive computer programmer who has gone from being a college dropout to a multi-billionaire and perhaps the world's most recognizable entrepreneur in 5 or 6 years. So it's hard to assume that there's anything really devious about Zuckerberg, although I think many of his ideas are absurd, and my book is actually built around that. He says, for example, you only have one identity. When you say something like that, that really is the naivety of a child. But there are other people, I think, who are much more sophisticated, who perhaps might be misleading people. Mark, the woman at Facebook who makes the trains run on time, the chief operating officer, is Sheryl Sandberg. She's older, much more experienced, much wiser than Mark Zuckerberg. And she wrote last year in The Economist that Facebook was great because it had finally enabled people to become authentic. Now, Sheryl Sandberg went to Harvard. She worked for Larry Summers. She's no fool. But when you say something ludicrous like that, I think you have to be held to account, because she's saying that before Facebook, we couldn't be authentic as human beings. And that's such an absurd statement. So I do think we have to be a little bit more critical when very smart, very wealthy, very powerful people like Sheryl Sandberg say such absurd things.
Will the marketplace create opportunities for ways in which, and maybe it's Web 4.0 down the road, where technology helps us create this greater depth that we were talking about earlier?
Absolutely, and that's where I'm becoming more and more optimistic. We're already seeing a new wave of companies focused on making privacy the core of their product. As I said, Microsoft just announced a very, very important reform to their browser last week. You have a new wave of companies, Reputation.com, for example, based in Silicon Valley. New startup focusing on privacy. A new search engine called DuckDuckMe, which is backed by a very notable New York venture capitalist, Fred Wilson, which is built around privacy, which is built around guaranteeing the users of that search engine that their data won't be used in any way to sell to advertisers. So I think this is the next wave, and I think you're seeing already a consumer reaction against Facebook. I wrote a piece for CNN last week questioning a lot of what Facebook was doing, talking about the way in which Facebook thinned out the human condition. Ironically enough, perhaps, it got almost 20,000 Facebook likes from a single article on CNN. So I think there is this growing groundswell of opposition and skepticism to Facebook. And I think there are new technologies now being developed in the universities that will enable, for example, data to degrade, which is another very, very important reform that will make data more like the real world, just as writing and physical things degrade. So data should degrade. We're living in the data world. We're living in a world where people say data is the new oil. That's fine. It's a reality. It's unavoidable. But let's enable data to degrade so that when we do something silly or when we post something silly, eventually it will go away.
Will there be, as we saw in the industrial age, as the knowledge economy matures, will there be this greater appreciation for something we touched on earlier, the individualization of creativity and the importance of that, more than just this crowdsourcing idea?
Well, again, my reference point in my book is John Stuart Mill's Great Defense of Individualism on Liberty. And in that book, he talks about the struggle between the individual and the collective being a cyclical thing. Every civilization struggles with this clash, and every civilization tries, some with success, some without, to carve out space for the individual. So there's no guarantee one way or the other. This is an ongoing theme in the history of our species. Now, I think over the last 200 or 300 years, we've done a reasonably good job carving out space for the individual, certainly in the industrial age in the West. But the digital age offers new challenges, so there's no guarantee that that's going to be done. That's why this is such an important issue. That's why we all need to think so carefully about how we use all this new technology. And we need to understand that it goes beyond simply whether we should or shouldn't be on Facebook, but more broadly, how we live our lives in the digital age, how much about ourselves we're going to reveal, how dependent we become on crowdsourced material.
Andrew Keen, the book is Digital Vertigo, How Today's Online Social Revolution is Dividing, Diminishing, and Disorienting Us. Andrew, as always, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Well, that was a wonderful interview. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.